This is our last session for the semester, and obviously we're not wrapping up the end of history. We'll pick up with the Reformation in January. If between now and then, if you've been reading through Volume 1, there's Volume 2 is available. You can order a copy over the holidays if you want. We will order a few copies whenever we kick off the class in January, but those of you ambitious readers might want to pick one up and do a little light reading over the Christmas holiday. So tonight we just kind of wrap up the period of the Renaissance that Garrett talked about last week, and some of the build up towards the Reformation. You know, one of the things a lot of people don't identify with Reformation is that there were a lot of people in the Catholic Church that were unhappy with what was going on in the Catholic Church leadership. There was attempts at Reformation being made within Catholicism. And so Martin Luther and John Calvin were not the first nor the only ones disgruntled, but they did kind of chart off on a different course. Obviously, they sought Reformation apart from the Catholic Church, whereas others would operate within the system of Catholicism. The notes I've given you tonight really are one half of what we're going to talk about, because the missionary movement of the Catholic Church really began to expand right, you know, the late 1400s and into the 1500s, which is will play a factor during the Reformation, but much of Reformation history is going to take place in Europe. So this set of notes here, early reform movements, it's kind of a note summary of Gonzalez's chapter 34 and 35. And he breaks down the movements really into three things. He talks about how there were attempts at conciliar reform. Did y'all talk about any of the councils last week? As I know you talked about popes becoming more and more corrupt and wicked. And so as popes, with the pinnacle being the Borgias, but a variety of other popes, began showing an inability to continue moving the church in the right direction, an inability to remove nepotism from the church, the appointing of family members, the inability to remove simony from the cardinalate and the papal office, simony being the purchasing of offices. And right around this time, we start seeing the rising of the use of indulgences. Did you talk about indulgences any? The church, man, they've built this elaborate system of doing church, and we gotta keep things going. And all of a sudden, we don't have the money we had, and we're not sending people on crusades and inheriting all of their estate or bringing back treasures. And so we got to find a way to fund these, you know, fancy lifestyles of the cardinals. And what was the idea? Well, we'll sell people forgiveness. People can buy their way into heaven by investing and committing to the church. And so a whole system, but really those three things, nepotism, simony, indulgences would become some of the biggest gripes of the reformers. Certainly not the only complaints, not the only corruptions. But as the popes continued to go down, there were attempts by a number of the cardinals to take the main authority away from the popes and put it in the church gathered councils, that we can gather together really in what you would see practiced today more in a Presbyterian example, maybe in a Methodist denomination, where there's not one head, but it's a variety of leaders, almost an oligarch style of government instead of a monarchy style of government. But the councils, they would say, have the primary authority, and the councils would meet periodically. Once they first began, I think the intent was to meet every 7 years. You don't see these named as ecumenical councils because the eastern part of the church was still schismed away from the west. I don't think that's a real word, but I just made it up. They were divided from the west. So they weren't ecumenical councils. They were just councils of the Western Catholic Church or the Roman Catholic Church. Councils being one of them. Another attempt at reform was made with theology. In other words, there were leaders and writers who felt like the doctrines of the Catholic Church were not entirely accurate. And so they tried to do a little bit of reform from the theological or academic point of view. The notes here pick up, if you're on page 153, that first page, this big Roman numeral number 2, it gives you the two great 14th century reformers. 14th century being the 1300s, John Wycliffe being one of them. On the next page, John Huss being the second. These two guys, in large part, what made them most uncomfortable or what their observation was, and it seems so commonsensical to us today, but they looked at the state of the church and they said, you know what? Popes are fallible and corruptible. Councils, cardinals are fallible and corruptible. The one thing that's not fallible and corruptible is the Word of God. And so, particularly John Wycliffe, you see under number 3, really emphasized the inspiration of the Bible and teaching of the fathers was superior to scholasticism and speculation of the schools. He really pushed back towards the Bible, even so much as saying, if popes didn't follow the Bible, then they shouldn't be viewed as legitimate popes. You can imagine that kind of sentiment is going to make enemies for John Wycliffe. The popes like the idea of being able to say, well, now I'm the pope, and so with the papal office comes the authority to basically do whatever I want, say whatever I want. And Wycliffe kind of began turning people's attentions back towards the importance of the Bible over and against whoever was pope. Yes. Wycliffe, I think that he was Catholic, Walt, but I'm not positive. Do you know?
Yeah, he wouldn't be at this time.
Yeah, educated at Oxford, which might lead to some confusion that he was educated in England.
Well, the Church of England doesn't begin to exist until Henry VIII had all of his problems.
Okay.
So that was
1500. Okay. Here's part of what Wycliffe... Wycliffe, we still recognize his name today. There are ministries named after him, a ministry in particular named after him, and it primarily does what? Anybody know? Yeah, it's a Bible translation ministry. Yeah, Wycliffe sends missionaries into, in recent years, have sent missionaries into parts of the world where they don't have a recorded language, period. They don't have an alphabet. They don't have a grammar. All they have is a vocalic language. It's what's spoken, and the people are de facto illiterate. And so they'll send missionaries in there to go learn how to speak this language just from living with people and interacting with them and then building an alphabet for them and then, you know, cataloging grammar for them, all with the end purpose of being able to translate the Bible into whatever language happens to be spoken there. Wycliffe was, he really emphasized the importance of the Bible. He emphasized translating the Bible out of Latin into English, and so that the modern, if you weren't a priest, if you weren't a cardinal, then you could have access to the Bible. Obviously, it didn't become widely available yet because the Gutenberg Press has not been invented yet, But Wycliffe, I mean, those were kind of some of his big points. Ultimately, he kind of waxed and waned. He had influence among the people. Obviously, the hierarchy of the Catholic Church didn't much care for him, and so his life was moving back and forth between being in a safe spot, protected by his followers, and being the eye of attention by Catholic leaders. And so it was very much a roller coaster. You see number 8, he wrote De Eucharistia, in which he challenged the Catholic view of communion. That was caused him to be branded as a heretic of sorts. Number 10, he refused to recant his views. They were condemned at a council in 1382, and he was forced to retire out of ministry. He ended up dying. I don't know if he died of natural causes, but he wasn't tortured and executed, as will become the case with our second figure here. So,
lay or church official?
Wycliffe, he was official. He was given a position. You see, it references on number 11, Lutterworth. And he was given a position there, but I don't recall exactly what it was. Yeah. It was not a high ranking. It was more of kind of a local. I don't know if he was a bishop of that particular area. But he was an official of low capacity. John Huss was predominantly located in what is modern-day Czech Republic, referred to as Bohemian, not like the Queen song or the Wayne's World movie or modern art movements, but Bohemian of ethnicity, which located him in the Czech Republic. And he really followed in Wycliffe's position, challenging the authority of the papacy, the importance of the Bible. You see number 6 encountered resistance when he preached on the immorality of the clergy. How dare he point out that the religious leaders had concubines and harems and were stealing money from the poor and hoarding up treasures and letting people go hungry. And he called him out on that, but the hierarchical system of the Catholic Church really didn't create an opportunity for that to happen, because they would land on somebody and silence them or squelch their voice. All of this that happens when you start seeing this build up towards Reformation from a religious point of view in the Catholic Church, you see the exact same dynamic, even in recent years, not from a religious point of view, but a political point of view. When you have these revolutions that take place in places like Egypt, in places like Sudan and other countries, it's the same kind of dynamic, but here it was happening from a religious point of view, and it was more widespread than one country. We call it Reformation, but really, I mean, what this is nothing short of revolution within the religious life of the Western Church. And Wycliffe and Huss were rebels. They were revolutionaries of a religious sort, but they were speaking out against corrupt leadership, and corrupt leadership had all the power and all the influence and all the tools necessary to silence them. The story of Huss being imprisoned and ultimately executed is really a black eye on the Catholic Church for that time. He was promised safe passage to one of the councils in order to present and defend his theological position. Once he arrived, he was captured and imprisoned by the Pope, and he just kind of wandered from prison to prison to prison, being tortured, being challenged to recant his view and support. And actually, I believe Huss was being challenged to support the councils. This was a place at which the council wanted him to recant of heresies that he had never espoused or believed anyways. And so they said, if you'll recant from these heresies, then we'll let you go free. And he said, what you're asking me to do is recant from heresies that I never had to begin with. The only reason the councils wanted him to do that was because it propped up their power and made it look like the councils had this authoritative power over the popes and over the pope. Actually, at that point, we did have two popes. We had warring popes and over the church as a whole. But Huss refused to do that. Ultimately, that led to his being burned at the stake as a heretic. And so that's one of the reasons he's not only a reformer and revolutionary, but a martyr in the history of Christianity. So you see some of that story. It's obviously in Gonzalez's book, if you just want the bullet point version of it. Number 11, the Council of Constance, is the outline of those events. You see small letter F is he was convicted of heresy and burned at the stake in July of 1415. Both Wycliffe and Huss had a lot of followers. You know, their disciples and their group of people continued their work even after they were silenced. What is interesting for Hus and the Bohemians is that they developed this Bohemian Brethren you see under number 15. And 15, letter C, later the Bohemian Brethren became known as the Moravian Brethren.
We don't have
you don't have 155?
No,
well, thank you, copier. Well, I will tell you, and then we'll try and get those notes. Do any of the, do you mind?
I've got three things.
You do? The plot thickens. Yes, you may. Okay, here's what I've got 153, 54, 50. You should have 53. Do you guys have 54 and 55? You go straight to 56. Okay. You know how to run that copier?
I do if you tell me your code.
My passcode is 8541.
Shh. How many copies would you make?
I made 60 of the others, so just make 60. Just a front back of that page, Jennifer. Do you have anything you'd like to add?
Sure. let's see. When he was being burned at the stake, he actually, because one of the key things about his life is, again, it's a sort of, we still see this today. Yeah, that guy died, but he recanted of all of his sins, so that gives us justification for having killed him. They tried to get him to do exactly what you mentioned, and as he was being, he was tied to the stake. Fire was being lit. He said, "I have never committed the sins I was charged with," which is sort of Tyndale does the same thing when he's burned at the stake. Wycliffe does the same thing when he's being burned at the stake. So he says those things. He says, "I never committed these sins that I'm being accused of," because again, at sort of your last words are going to be significant. People are going to think about that for a while. Continue to think about that. There's a little anecdotal thing. They couldn't get the fire going really well to burn him at the stake, and so a very nice lady came up with some very wet brush and threw the brush on the fire to try to get it going a bit better. And he condemned her at that moment. told her get rid of this brush because I want to die quickly. Because I mean, it's not a charitable thing that happened.
There you go, Jan Hus. We will get more into the Moravian Brethren next semester, but basically these Bohemian Brethren, which gives birth to the Moravian Brethren, those whole Brethren kind of movements are going to develop what we would identify as Mennonites in large part. There's in the family tree to Mennonites. And out of Mennonites down the family tree are going to come Baptists eventually out of these Brethren as well. And so what we stand in, is that right? We'll get there inside the Protestant Reformation. So, but they definitely exist as, if we identify Protestants as those who are protesting the Catholic way of doing church, even after Hus dies, his Bohemian Brethren, Moravian Brethren, they really almost exist as the first Protestant denominations to spin away from Catholicism. Now, of course, they were able to exist in the Czech Republic, which was pretty far east, away from the centers of Catholicism in Italy and France. But they were Protestants before there were really Protestants. They were protesting before Martin Luther comes on the scene. Yeah. Yes. He is not the good King Wenceslas. Yes, yes. It is same part of the world. You are correct. Good King Wenceslas looked out on the Feast of Stephen. I should know what that is, but since it's my namesake, but I don't. So Wycliffe and Hus, I mean, we bring them up. Actually, Jennifer stole my notes, so now I don't have them. We bring them up because they identified this attempt at bringing about reform through theology during the same time. Within the Catholic Church, there were those trying to bring about reform through councils. They said papal leadership is corrupt. What we need is rule by many instead of rule by one. That wasn't really effective. And that conciliar movement lasted for a while, 100 years, 150 years. But the papal office eventually was able to regain its authority over the councils. So the conciliar movement was a failure. The theological attempts, you can kind of take that for what you will. Obviously, we think it was successful. It probably was a forerunner of some other theological movements later. The third one, and I've got four listed on my notes here. The third one mentioned by Gonzalez, he didn't spend as much time on the third as he does the first two. Conciliar movement, theology, apocalyptic expectations of the poor would be the third. Apocalyptic expectations. You realize apocalyptic ideas have always thrived much more with the poor. Apocalyptic expectations can keep the poor from rebelling because Jesus is coming soon, and when he does, you'll all get to go have a mansion in heaven. So be content in your state now instead of trying to work your way up the corporate ladder and take our positions as the wealthy. The caste system in modern day India and in some of the Hindu practices is very similar. If you're born into poverty or born into a low socioeconomic status, that is your lot, and that's been assigned to you by the gods, and you should stay there and live your life well. And the next go-round, the next cycle of life, then maybe you'll get promoted, so to speak. The same kind of dynamic that was going on here, the apocalyptic teachings were being used to keep the poor from rebelling or revolting. 1300s, 1400s, the church, while this is going on, the popes were really not any better than they had been. This is the same period that Garrett talked about last week with corruption and the papacy. It's not, again, when I think about the way revolutions work politically, you see a lot of the same elements existing here, building up to what's going to take place in the Reformation of the Catholic Church. So there are a variety of other notes in here. I didn't want to go through all of them, but Wycliffe and Huss were really the two big points to mention. One of the other things that's going on while the Reformation is going on in Europe is a couple of countries really begin their political expansion, kingdom expansion, and with it goes their religious expansion. Gonzalez gives an entire chapter over to each of these two predominant movers and shakers. One of them was the country of Spain, and one of them was Portugal. We readily identify with Spanish exploration because it brought Europeans here and to Mexico and the Caribbean and South America. And if you think about it today, all you have to do is look at modern geography and religion, and you kind of can identify what was going on in the 1400s. We think about Christopher Columbus in 1492 sailing the ocean blue. And as Columbus comes over here, he not only brings all of European civilization, Western civilization, but he also brings Western religion. He brings Christianity with him. Spain, through Columbus and other explorers and leaders, obviously had much more influence in the Caribbean, in Mexico, in Central America, in South America, basically everywhere you would go today where people predominantly speak Spanish. 500 years later, still, that was where the influence of Spanish conquest. Throughout that whole process, you would find both the conversion of, and sometimes forced conversions of, the Aztec nation, the Mayan nation, the Inca nations, many of the Caribbean islands. Portugal had some explorations in the west coast of Africa, but they worked their way over to this part of the world in one really, really significant place, which today still speaks Portuguese, and that would be the one place in South America that doesn't speak Spanish, which is Brazil. Not only does the language remain, but in those days, Spain and Portugal were predominantly, if not entirely, Catholic, and therefore the culture and the religion that they were bringing to Mexico and to Argentina and to all of South America, to places like Puerto Rico, to places like Cuba, the religion they were bringing was Catholicism. And to this day, in most of Latin America, where you see Christianity existing, it is in large percentage still Catholic. Of course, in the United States, whenever we turn to religion in colonial America, next semester, here we still speak English because it wasn't so much Spain and Portugal as it was England and France, with England ultimately winning the upper hand, and the Christianity that has more predominance here than most anywhere else is Protestant Christianity because of the British. And so it really is interesting when you think about the European expansion that began over 500 years ago, how those battle lines or ethnic lines or linguistic lines and even religious lines are still drawn 500 years later. How they've been able to continue and consist is pretty surprising. His two chapters are Spain and Portugal, and talks about their expansion. A lot of what the Spanish did, they would bring over military men and they would bring over missionaries. And when you think about those two going hand in hand, you can easily understand what the dynamic was like as the Spanish began to occupy all these places over here that still speak Spanish. They would come in and they would not enslave they referred to them as Indians, even in Latin America. But they would enslave the natives. They didn't call it enslaving because the Catholic Church would not allow that. And so what they called it a system of encomiendas, which meant we're going to take in some of you natives and teach you how to be proper citizens. We're going to enculture you. We're going to teach you how to read and write, teach you the language, convert you to Christianity. The problem was that all that deteriorated in almost every instance into slavery of the form that we think of when we think of civil rights kind of slavery. And so slavery of the Latin Americans was pretty common, particularly on the Caribbean islands. If they ended up running out of locals and natives to do their work for them, whether it was coal mining, whether it was gold mining, whether it was farming, if the Spanish started running out of locals, then what did they do? Well, that's when they started shipping in slaves from Africa. And that's why we have even still today in places like Haiti, Dominican Republic, Jamaica, some of the other Caribbean islands, Spanish speaking in some of those cases, dark-complected of African origin residents in those countries. And so anywhere you see a large population of black residents in Latin America, that's usually it's because there was a dwindling population of native slave labor. We have to go get more. Whenever you think about the way, of course, in the midst of all of this, Gonzalez talks about how the church had two different faces. With the Catholic Church coming to the Americas, it had two different faces. It had the side that was capitalistic. How can we capitalize on this? How can we make money? How can we send money back to Rome? How can we fund all of our offices, cardinalates, all of our bishoprics? And that was always prevalent in military movement, forced conversions, things of that nature. But then when the Spanish would bring missionaries over, a lot of times they would bring Franciscan monks, they'd bring Dominican monks, they would bring Jesuits over. And anytime they would bring over monks who were comfortable living in poverty, in fact, it was intended. We're going to bring those of our order that are okay living in poverty, we want to bring them over so they can go live among the natives in poverty and be comfortable and learn their language and get to know them and gain their trust. Well, the capitalizers thought that that would be a way that would help them control the natives, but what happens was they brought over very compassionate, kind Christians that would go out and live amongst the natives and learn their language, and then what would happen? They would really take seriously their role of being shepherds, defending the rights of the natives, caring for them, deep in compassion. A couple of stories, if you didn't read through Gonzalez, that you should. Some really strong missionary moments within the Catholic Church took take place in Colombia, especially around Cartagena, in Asunción, Paraguay, in Argentina. The Jesuits went in and started creating, what did they call them? They didn't call them, they weren't churches, the Jesuit locations. They were like communes where people would come and the natives would come, they'd be educated, they'd be taught, opportunity to convert. But the Jesuits kept trying to minister to people, and the Portuguese from Brazil kept encroaching and trying to take over through military might. And so the Jesuits went from being farmers and agrarians and helping the natives understand how to grow food to having to teach them how to make weapons and how to build walls and how to defend themselves and how to be an army. But the Jesuits were very ministry-minded. The monks, in most cases, the Franciscans, I believe, would have been more poverty-related than the Dominicans, correct? A lot of expansion. I mean, when you think about Franciscans named after St. Francis, the Spanish movement came, a lot of involvement in Mexico. That movement came north of Mexico into New Mexico. Ultimately, the city of Santa Fe was a place that was established by the Catholic Church. Santa Fe is Saint Francis, I believe. Isn't that correct?
I'm not sure.
I think that it is, yeah. It does mean faith, but it was the full name of the city is not Santa Fe. The larger name of the city is... let me see if I can find it. Just so you know, I'm not making up stuff. I don't know if I highlighted it or not. It was the search for seven golden cities, El Dorado. Here you go, bottom of 457, Villa Real de la Santa Fe de San Francisco de Asís. The full name of the city was, Santa Fe of St. Francis of Assisi. And so, you go to Santa Fe, that's history going all the way back to Spanish exploration of the Catholic Church, looking for the cities of gold so that they could, take all that gold and distribute it amongst their leaders and carry some of that back to fund, the operations of the Catholic Church in Western Europe. A lot more connectedness. You know, we're told the story, story of world history, story of American history, a lot of times apart from religion. And in reality, religion is not just a byproduct or a partial component. It was a leading component in so much of what happened historically. It was always interesting to me, after taking world history and American history and even Western civilization in college, and learning about all these historic events, Columbus and, exploration and wars in Europe, the Hundred Years' War and things like that, and not really ever being educated on the religious dots that connect a lot of these pieces, and then going back and having to take church history, history of Christianity, and seeing how it all flows together. It all operates, especially in the Western world. In the Eastern world, it does as well, just with different religions other than Christianity. And so it doesn't quite make as much sense to us. But throughout these years, I mean, Columbus sailing the ocean blue didn't just bring Western literature and culture and art and languages and diseases and agricultural advancements. It brought European religion in a way that... we can look back on it and say, man, forced militaristic conversions to Christianity, I don't know that any of us would be in favor of that today. You look at the legacy that a lot of that missionary expansion and military expansion has. You know, South America is probably more populous as far as Christianity goes. Brazil is one of the highest percentage within the country of Christians in the world today, more so than the United States is. And so the legacy in history continues to carry forward very influentially based on the events that took place during that time period. Yeah. I will, and I'll do the best I can to answer it, but Garrett may be more qualified to answer this one. She asked, how did the missionaries get connected? Or how did the missionaries get connected with the explorers? With Columbus's first expedition, I don't think it was really an intentional part of what he was doing. When he returned back and delivered reports to Ferdinand and Isabella, you know, there was a whole lot of political moving of parts between rulers in Spain and people like Columbus that was traveling. But on his second expedition, they sent missionaries with him. They sent a team of missionaries, 10 or 12, with him on his second expedition, which landed in Caribbean islands. The first large part of missionary work was Puerto Rico, maybe Cuba. It was Caribbean. And then from there, it would extend into Mexico and then gradually into... And you hear different names. You know, Central America, an explorer named Balboa was very influential in exploring. And but from Columbus on, anytime exploration was done, religion went with it. It was part of it. What you would hear Spanish explorers say is that the Pope is the prelate of God on earth, and he has dictated that this land where we are exploring has been given to Spain, and we are here. And so we will give you an opportunity to convert to Christianity and join us, and if you do not, then we're going to take it by force anyways, but we'll let you become Christians and join us, and you can become our slaves, or we'll take up arms and kill you and take your land anyways. Yeah. Listen, when skeptics, I mean, if you get into conversations with people that are very skeptical about the church, that have atheistic tendencies because of the church's operations throughout its history, the church's history is sordid, to say the least. But in many of these cases, what you find is the church and the government, the church and political power were bed partners for so much of this history. And it made it very easy for the church to be conscripted by emperors, kings. Even the Pope was a position of politics, of power and authority and money. It made it very easy for them to do things like theology and councils and wars and missionary movement, all to serve purposes. And you understand why people like John Wycliffe would sit back and kind of begin some of this Reformation thinking and say, why do we give the Pope carte blanche power to say whatever he wants and do whatever he wants whenever it doesn't line up with especially when it doesn't line up with what the Bible says? When it has all of the air of evil and sinfulness and wickedness. And Wycliffe and Huss began giving voice to those, of course, bringing on them all of the hatred and violence that the Catholic Church, that the popes could muster. But that's part of it, is that usually the sins of the Christian church are magnified, and the ministries and the compassion and the care and the development that took place also hand in hand is overlooked. The patron saint of slaves his story is shared in it's in the chapter, here it is, it's in the chapter on Spain, Colombia and Venezuela, page 461. It talks about two influential figures in Colombia, The first one, Louis Beltran, is interesting, but the second one, Pedro Claver, is the patron saint of slaves. Slaves were being brought over from Africa to fill in the gaps for Latin American slaves, and this monk would spend all of his time basically going on the ships and caring for the sick whenever they would arrive and going into their bunkhouses and helping to carry out the dead whenever they died and washing their washing their sores whenever they would get smallpox and caring for the slaves that got leprosy. And I mean, it's incredibly convicting and motivating. And so those are the kinds of stories. Yeah, the corruptibility of the church was written large throughout the history of what took place. The mercy and compassion and what I would call the Christ-likeness of the church was always present. It was always present in voices like John Wycliffe. It was always present. It just usually happened to be present in those who would be more representative of a baby born in a manger in a backwater town like Bethlehem instead of a king born in a palace surrounded by luxury and attendants and, the excesses of the hierarchy of the Catholic Church during that time period. And as we all know, it's the politicians and the kings that write their history that have big movements. The corruption of the church was always present, but the kindness and mercy and Christ-likeness of the Christian church was also present in equal measure. Those stories just aren't always as visible or as common as some of the others. We know much more about the wars than we do the poor patron saint who cares for slaves in Colombia when all the other Spanish Christians are, abusing them and et cetera, et cetera. That's not a good story to tell. It's not dramatic, but it is in every sense what we believe to be right and what we believe to be the true representation of the church. So we're into the 1500s. 1492, Columbus sails. A lot of this expansion would take place over the next 100 years, the 1500s. Wycliffe and Huss in the 1300s. The 15th century is going to be, it already is, the bubbling up of disgruntlement and corruption. You have individuals kind of on the edges with Martin Luther, with John Calvin, with Ulrich Zwingli. We get guys in the heart of the Roman Catholic world, and the Reformation is going to go from a slow simmer to a full-on boil and explosion in quick time. And with the Reformation, I mean, you guys realize church history for the most part from 300 with Constantine until 1500, around Reformation, we've had 1,200 years roughly that is large part dictated by Catholicism. And even when it's not Catholicism, it's Orthodoxy, which is Catholicism just of a slightly different variety and takes its own path, but still very formal, still very liturgical. Protestantism is... the Reformation is going to splinter the church into all kinds of directions. I was talking with somebody a couple of weeks ago about, actually, it was somebody I run into at the gym who's not a Christian anyways, maybe an agnostic at best, but just talking about some of the sentiment about, he'd asked me about the Robert Jeffress's comments about ISIS from the pulpit. I don't know if you guys saw the video from First Baptist Dallas. Was asking me about that and if that was the kind of Baptist church we were. and I told him not exactly, but we got to talking about that. And I told him, I said, it's really interesting when you look at what's going on in the Islamic world today. The history of Islam really charts kind of parallel with the history of Christianity, just about 500 or 600 years behind us. Which, interestingly enough, Muhammad was about 500 or 600 years behind Jesus. Forever, Islam has been predominated by two strains. If you're a Muslim, you're either Sunni or you're Shiite or Shia. for the longest time in Christianity, you were either Catholic or Orthodox. I mean, that's how you were until you hit this crisis point at which Christianity was, in some ways, everything you would hope it would be, but in some ways, the entire corrupt, I mean, the Spanish Inquisition, the papal tortures that were used. Look, there is nothing going on right now in the Middle East that couldn't be multiplied over and over and over again in our own history, that popes and cardinals and bishops didn't do to people they deemed to be heretics within their own system of belief. You know, Aaron has done a good job reminding us that while certain radicals are attacking Christians, they're attacking other Muslims in larger quantities than they are outsiders. And Islam is, you know, there's this contingent that wants to continue moving forward as a world citizen, as a world partner, moving towards respectability and peace. And then you have these others that are seeking power and money and wanting to force people to join them or execute them or punish them accordingly. There's very little going on in that whole storyline today that didn't go on in our own storyline 600, 700 years ago. And it's almost frightening to think about the parallels. You may hear me say from time to time that to me it's evidence, although I would see where people might think contrary, but that the Church of Jesus has continued to grow and continue to evolve and continue to become more. People think that today we're the worst we've ever been. If we can only go back to the 60s and 70s, we're going to hell in a handbasket. The church is in a worse place than it's ever been. People that think that don't know the history of the Christian church. The Christian church today is more like Jesus, I think, in my opinion, than it's ever been. It is more global than it's ever been. It's more compassionate, more merciful, more peaceable than it's ever been. Now, does that mean it's perfectly all of those things? Absolutely not. Do we have some regression, perhaps, within the Christian community in our country? Well, I would probably take that argument that we may be. We've regressed in our country. But in places like South America and China, even in the Middle East, the church is growing it by leaps and bounds. And so, look, our history is sordid at best. But the incredible thing is that it continues to grow, evolve, develop, become better, become more like what we think God has called us to be and wants us to be. And you can either just say that that's by chance, that's just been the fortunes of history, but for that to have taken place through all of this and everything that's going to come, Reformation moving forward and continue building, kingdoms and empires don't last that long. You know, the Roman Empire, for all of its glory, didn't last that long. The Ottoman Empire lasted a really long time. The Byzantine Empire lasted a really long time. Empires rise and fall, but the Church of Jesus Christ, for the better part of 2,000 years, has continued to evolve and develop, sometimes because of us, but more often than not, in spite of us. And that's what's incredible. So, yeah.
Eastern Orthodox Church, did it sort of go the same way as well, splinter?
No, not as much. Now the hub of Orthodoxy would move with the Turks in bringing the Ottoman Empire in, with the Turks taking Constantinople and the fall of the Byzantine Empire. Orthodoxy is going to shift, and its center is no longer going to be Constantinople. Its center is really going to be Greece, which is why Greek Orthodoxy still is very prevalent. Its center is going to be Egypt, Cairo, Alexandria, with Coptic Orthodoxy. But we talked, just gave it a brief mention back several weeks ago, whenever Russia was becoming a country around the turn of the millennium, their leaders, I don't know if it was Peter or if it was Nicholas, instead of looking to Rome and Western Europe for their religious undertakings, they looked to Constantinople, and therefore Russian became Orthodox like the Eastern Church. And today, Russia is one of the largest, if not the largest, center of Orthodoxy. Russian Orthodoxy, Greek Orthodoxy, Coptic Orthodoxy are probably the three largest, and they're all similar with obviously different, you know, details, different strains as they've gone their own way. But they're still, you know, very iconic, you know, very liturgical, very, very hierarchical in their system of leadership. They don't have a pope. That's the one big difference, is they're not papal led. They don't have a single figure that's the leader. It's much more like bishops that lead in different areas. But no, you didn't have anything like a Protestant Reformation. The only thing that happened to the Eastern Orthodox churches is whenever the Protestant Reformation spread west, and then from the west continued spreading everywhere else. And so ultimately, it would be centuries later, but ultimately the Protestant Reformation out of Europe that affected the Roman Catholic Church would carry over into the rest of the Eastern world. Yeah.
It seems to be such an overwhelming, obvious thing. Is it being neglected, or is it being more and more emphasized in this era that we're in now?
Yeah, that we're in now? Very much so. Yeah, his comment about people hearing the scriptures and the stories in their own language, it's part of why, you know, the Jesuits were so effective. Was they would go in and live with people and learn their dialects and learn their languages. The armies didn't care. But today, you still have a lot of that today. I mean, with Wycliffe translators trying to translate scripture, a big movement just in the last decade and the way we do missiology has been a transition away from preaching and doctrine and theology to storytelling. A lot of emphasis in going into non-Christian environments, and instead of going in and with Evangelcube and laying out your sevenfold road to salvation, going in and telling the stories of the Old Testament. It's kind of a nice refresher, going and telling stories about Abraham and Isaac, and telling stories about Jonah and the city of Nineveh, the stories about Elijah and the prophets of Baal. Because stories, especially in, I hate to say lesser educated, but, you know, in lesser educated environments, in places where there's a little bit more tendency towards the supernatural in whatever form, these stories, in our society, we go tell those stories, and Jonah got swallowed by a fish and spit up on dry ground, and the educated, scientific, cynical culture in America does what? Whatever, you really believe that's true. And a lot of other places where the gospel's not reached, you can go in and tell those stories. And their cultures have their own body of stories that are not too far-fetched from things like, you know, things like Elijah calling down fire on the top of Mount Carmel. And so that's not one for one what you were saying, Larry, but you do hear missionaries are learning how to tell those stories in a way that's compelling, that also connects people to the gospel. And being even if they don't have scripture in their own languages, you start translation by being able to put some of these stories in languages that can be used as missionary tools. And the missionary organizations that I'm familiar with, they find that to be a lot more effective today than some of the strategies we've used in the past. So. It's not only the same language they're using, but almost coming at it culture to culture. We're speaking your language, but not only in words, but also in everything else that goes around with your language and your culture.
I can't imagine sitting there Sunday after Sunday forever listening to the word.
In Latin. Yeah.
And not understanding a word they're saying and expect to grow in understanding and faith.
Yeah. Growth and understanding was not important. Obedience was important. Do what we tell you. Yeah. Do what we tell you.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So, the first semester of history covers, again, 1,500 years, roughly. The second semester covers a third of that, and that's because we hit the Reformation and it's a grenade going off, and shrapnel goes everywhere, and different traditions go everywhere. And with these missionary movements, the church exists in a lot more places, and so the strains are different. The confusion of the state of the church today, you could look at it as confusion, Or you could also look at it as a byproduct of the Church of Jesus becoming connected to humanity in all of its many multifarious languages and cultures and histories and traditions. And so it could be, you know, you can look at a mosaic and you can think, well, that's a jumbled mess. I don't see anything there. Or if you have the right perspective, you can look at a mosaic and think, well, that's really beautiful. That's a whole lot of things working together to make one gorgeous thing. And we will see in the Reformation and the history after that you could look at it either way, but hopefully we'll see the advancement of the church in a positive light. So it's 7:15. I promised Matt we would be done by 7:15 because they're rehearsing, full rehearsal for the choir and orchestra program tonight, and we want to be fair with their time. So this wraps up the semester. We'll get started early, not the first week of January, just kind of keep tabs on the bulletin, maybe the second Wednesday of January, and we'll pick up with the Reformation. So it'll be the same format in the spring as it's been in the fall. Garrett and I will be sharing the load. I've got seventh grade basketball games that are on Wednesday nights that I need to be at least occasionally. But we'll share the responsibilities, and if you want to pick up, again, Gonzalez Volume 2, it's available on Amazon. You can get it on your own, and if you can't, then we'll have some in the spring that you can get. So thank you guys for hanging with us. Let's do it again in a few weeks.